From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court clears the way for all states to allow legal sports betting.
You know, why shouldn't you be able to bet on your favorite sports team when you can go and spend as much as you want on a 3 or 4 digit number?
John Eubacon on that old sexual assault indictment against Lions coach Matt Patricia.
Were you there that night? Was there sex? If you have a story, and apparently you have a different story, we should hear it.
Providers and advocates worry about Michigan taking a step closer to privatizing mental health care.
We all understand their budgetary concerns. We all understand their politics at play here. But what's being forgotten are the people that we serve.
The singer from Warren who grew up to be an impersonator of Frank Sinatra.
Because he's the only one who transcends every generation. He's as popular today as he ever was.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, today marks the 20th anniversary of the passing of Frank Sinatra. We'll talk with Bob Anderson, Michigan native and Vegas' top impressionist of old blue eyes. But first, a U.S. Supreme Court decision today has swept away Nevada's monopoly on illegal sports betting. The 6-3 decision means states can opt to legalize sports betting and enjoy the tax benefits. With us now is State Representative Robert Kosowski, a Democrat from Michigan's 16th House District. Representative, what was your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, let me tell you, it's a great day for Michigan residents because finally we can be on the same par as Nevada, and people that like sports betting may have that chance.
Tell us why you believe this could be good for Michigan.
Well, you know, a lot of people are already gambling. They do it illegally right now. They can go on their phone and go out of any offshore account while the state is not receiving any money. Is it all about money? No, but it sure will help when we don't have to raise our taxes, registration fees. We can fix our roads and not go back to our residents.
Now, I know there are some bills circulating in the legislature about this, including yours. I'm wondering, what was it that first brought this, put this on your radar screen?
Well, honestly, it was to have a solution. When I came to Lansing, you know, 5.5 years ago, I wanted to have an answer for anything that I was going to introduce. I have 152 bills introduced right now, and this is one of them. And I thought it was a pot of money, thinking outside the box, to regulate sports gambling, which has a lot of effects. I mean, right now, there's no awareness programs. With the sports betting, we can have people go to the casinos, bet on sports, and if they are recognized as a problem, people can help them. Plus, tourism is just going to go off the charts with this. The restaurants, the hotels, it's going to be a destination point.
In a nutshell, what would the bills that are circulating, including yours, what would they do?
So the main component of this bill is to allow sports betting to take place in brick-and-mortar locations, which are casinos. That includes the tribal casinos as well. We have some work to do with them on this, but, you know, it allows people to go in there and bet on their favorite team and don't have to go through the black market.
Now, do you expect any movement on these bills now that the Supreme Court has ruled?
I do. Brant Eyden, who is the Reg Reform chairman, he has informed me that we're going to take another hearing in this. We already had one. I'm pretty sure that all leadership's on board with this. I mean, it makes perfect sense to help raise money instead of letting, you know, the black market get it.
And let's talk about the politics for a moment. Do you think you can get enough support from Republicans and your fellow Democrats to pass any of these measures?
I think so. And I'll tell you why. Because if you look and if a conservative person says, no, gambling is wrong, then I say let's blow everything up. I say let's say no more lottery, which goes to our schools. I say no more bingos, which helps nonprofits. You know, why shouldn't you be able to bet on your favorite sports team when you can go and spend as much as you want on a 3 or 4 digit number? It's gambling.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Would voters not then have to approve any expansion of gambling per that constitutional amendment that passed in 2004, the one that allowed the three Detroit casinos?
It's actually a great question. And I feel, and I'm not an attorney, but I feel that it says that the brick-and-mortar places are allowed, the three Detroit casinos are allowed to have gambling. Doesn't specify what type of gambling. So I think, sure, I think they can maybe go for it right now.
So what do you say to people listening to us who just don't believe gambling is an appropriate solution to our budget woes?
So, you know, I agree to them to a point. But then if we want to do that, as I said earlier, let's just stop all gambling. Let's not allow a bingo. Let's not have these peel stickers that you can get, you know, on the lottery. Let's not have scratch-offs. I mean, every gas station you walk into, you see 50 different kinds of scratch-offs. I think that's more troublesome than sports gambling, because sports gambling, there is some skill involved. Scratching off an instant ticket, there's no skill involved in that.
Democrat Robert Kosowski represents the city of Wayne and part of Westland in the State House. Representative, thanks for being with us today, reacting to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that means states can opt to legalize sports betting.
Awesome. Thank you.
New Lions head coach Matt Patricia has found himself at the center of a Detroit news story that reports he'd been arrested in March 1996 when he was a college student and indicted for aggravated sexual assault. The case collapsed when the accuser decided she did not want to testify. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here with us now. John, there have been such a range of comments on Facebook and Twitter, and this is one typical one I want to get your take on. It was posted by a woman, and here's what she wrote. I'm really disappointed, not in the alleged account that happened over 20 years ago, but the fact that this was made into a story. For what purpose? He's been found innocent 22 years ago. I'm sick of hearing these stories that don't carry any legitimate merit. Was he found guilty? No. Has he exhibited any other behavior like this that's been reported on? No. Then how did this own the news cycle? John, what do you think?
Well, first of all, he was not found innocent. The indictment was dropped. He was indicted, and in the rules for indictment, I had to look all this stuff up. Mm. It varies widely. However, in Texas, it's pretty much the same as Michigan, which is the judge has got to believe you've shown probable cause for the case to go forward, which does not, frankly, mean a lot in the case of sexual assault, because it almost always boils down to he said, she said. But So probable cause to move forward was determined, and now you've got a case. Now, the case never went to trial. I'm telling you right now, from a journalistic point of view, this is your worst nightmare, because the gravity of the case argues both directions. It's so serious, aggravated assault, that to not report even on an indictment seems negligent. However, it is also so serious that if the case never went forward, he never had a chance to face his accuser, never had a chance to defend himself in court, never had a chance to be found not guilty. That also argues for you're going to ruin Manning's career over we're not quite sure what.
Mm.
So this is damned if you do and damned if you don't.
We should note the Free Press over the weekend updated the story saying this sexual assault case against Patricia had at least 5 trial witnesses, a nurse, a doctor, a police detective, a police officer, and a college friend of the alleged victim. And the local district attorney in Cameron County, Texas, basically said to the Free Press the same thing. This is not a question of whether something happened. It's whether the victim consented. The defendant says she did. Victim says she didn't.
The consent cases, again, I'm not a lawyer. I went to law school for 5 minutes. That does not count for much.
No.
But the consent cases are the hardest, I think. If you can say I was not in that hotel room, that wasn't me, et cetera, that's a whole different case. Nothing happened is a whole different case, which doctors and others can help you with, prove or not prove. Consent. Consent is an emotional state. Consent is, you know, it's a lot of things, but it's not, consent's going to boil down to he said, she said, usually.
And the indictment, as we say, dates back to when Patricia was a college football player on spring break. So again, we're talking 22 years ago. And he said in his brief press conference last week, he's a victim, and this is his quote, of those trying to damage my career and my credibility. Was it on him to tell the Lions about what happened 22 years ago?
I would think yes. And for this reason. When I was the hockey coach at Ann Arbor here in high school, the rule was very simple, no surprises. So if one of my kids was going to get in trouble, we had academic ineligibility coming up, man, I made the first call. And that way you're a lot wiser saying, look, I want you to know this 22 years earlier, and you can have his version of it, obviously. What we've not done in the press room yet is ask him the proper question, which is, were you there? Were you there that night? Was there sex? If you have a story, and apparently you have a different story, we should hear it at this point. I do think that the seriousness of it, it's hard to ignore. And yet I also feel very conflicted for the same reason. To indict somebody and then drop the case is going to paint the guy forever as somewhat guilty in most people's eyes without a chance again to defend himself. So this is exceedingly uncomfortable for me. on both sides. And I go back to the Duke LaCrosse case. You can't ignore
it. Yes, got to talk about that. In the Duke LaCrosse case, we should just remind everybody, where a woman in North Carolina accused three Duke players of gang rape. The national media pounced on the story, and then the accuser's entire story fell apart. And a lot of journalists had to admit they'd been had.
Not been had. We had done horrible work. Now, I grant you that Mike Nifong, the DA in Durham, North Carolina, was not only removed from his post, which is exceedingly rare in these cases, he was disbarred and jailed for his unbelievably horrible work. That's so unheard of. So that's how bad it was. Now, if you've got a DA that off the rails, as a journalist, you're probably at the mercy of the guy to some degree. We tend to believe these guys. But that, I mean, the old line goes back decades and applies to the Duke lacrosse players. Where do you go to get your reputation back? In the case of those Duke lacrosse players, look, I mean, it was easy to believe, sadly. A bunch of rich kids are known to be spoiled brats, frankly, and had a record of mildly bad behavior. It was not hard to believe, sadly. But these guys in the internet era, he's right. You apply for any job from now on, there's no way that's not coming up.
Lions have made a very strong statement of supporting Patricia. You had owner Martha Ford standing there at the press conference. Would a player in exactly the same situation have gotten the same support?
New terrain. I would say, think off the top of my head, yes. For two reasons. One, if you're a player, it's more recent. You might well be within the statute of limitations, and therefore things are still alive. Second of all, you have one head coach, you got a lot of players. The head coach, frankly, is more important than most of the players. It's how it works. So it's very disruptive to change a coach. I will say Martha Ford has made her stance. I knew she's going to be strong one way or the other. I wasn't sure which direction. And she is quietly strong, and she is someone you do not underestimate.
What do you think the NFL coaches, owners, fans take away from this whole furor around Matt Patricia?
That the past is not the past. That's one thing. And not being found not guilty or not innocent, case being dropped, it's still out there. You can count on the NFL, whatever the right thing to do is, you can count on the NFL not doing it. Sad to say. This is a league, by the way, that refused to believe one of its star players had abused his wife until they showed the video of him doing so in the elevator, which they had for months, which they knew. So the NFL is the more arbiter. I'll tell you what, I'll take a DA any day over the NFL.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John Eubacon. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a theater in Detroit commissions a play that gives its playwright an unprecedented blank slate. Then, in 20 minutes, is the Michigan legislature on its way to privatizing the state's mental health system? Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Public Theater is wrapping up its third season with a new play that it commissioned, Birthday Candles, written by Grand Rapids native Noah Heidel. His work has been produced in New York, regionally, and around the world. And his original screenplay for the 2013 film Stand Up Guys starred Al Pacino, Alan Arkin, and Christopher Walken. Noah Heidel, welcome.
Thank you. My first time stateside.
Wonderful. And we hope not the last. Birthday Candles. This idea is fascinating. Taking us through the life of a woman named Ernestine Ashworth. How old is Ernestine when we first meet her?
She's 17. We meet her on our 17th birthday.
And by the end of the play?
By the end of the play, she has stopped counting.
She stopped counting. Now, what inspired that idea for you, Noah?
Well, this play actually was born out of kind of necessity. The Detroit Public Theater commissioned me, and I believe it's unprecedented in maybe the entire history of American theater, where they commissioned a play blind. It didn't have a title, not anything, and they said, okay, whatever you do, we're going to slot it into our production schedule. So I guess I designed partly the play to fit their practical needs. And so the impetus creatively was tied into trying to make it small, trying to make it a low production necessities in terms of finances, and easily repeatable, because I hope that this is the beginning of the life of this play.
Yeah, and we should note that DPT works out of the Max Fisher Center, where the DSO is, and it's a black box. So you're right. You've got certain restraints and also probably freedoms.
Right, and personally, I love restraints. I think I think if one was given an infinite amount of time and an infinite amount of resources, I don't know if the creative product would be any better than very little time and very little resources. So for me, I've tried to figure out ways to make a play seem a lot bigger with less people. So a lot of my plays have a lot of doubling. In this play, I believe there's 10 characters or 12 or something with 6 actors.
And that's fun for an audience to see an actor stretch to be person A and then character B and so on. You go, wow, that is a lot of fun for an audience, I find. I love that when you can see somebody get put through their acting paces.
Right. And one of the ways I hope to do it is that in this play, you see generations of, you see an actor play the mother, and then that same actor, you know, 5 minutes later, play the daughter. And then 5 minutes later, you see that same actor play the granddaughter. So it's not just doubling for practical use. I think it's doubling with an unconscious effect. So it's not just the practical, it's the using it to heighten the story, hopefully.
Yeah, that sounds great. Noah, when I think about, for example, a novelist releasing his or her work into the world versus a playwright. So the novelist is not sitting there at home watching the reader go through the book, but there you are in the theater taking in the audience reaction for better or for worse. Can you share with us a little of what that's like?
Absolutely. I think if a playwright is looking for a production to be an execution of their vision, they are going to have a very unfortunate life. It is, when you put it in real time, when you put it with real people, money, nerves, levels of ability, you deal with what you got. And so I'm in rehearsal all the time. I write a lot. I rewrite a lot with the actors that I have in front of me in mind. Like for this, this actor, Daniel, can play the guitar really well. And he kind of plays a funny next-door neighbor. And so he plays the guitar really well. And I worked it in narratively that that's effective. I really feel that a production, for me, is a record of our time together in terms of these actors and this production team. And also the practical necessities of, for instance, this set is very wide. So sometimes actors have long crosses. So rather than have them do that in the clear, I write lines for them. So this script is tailored to the actors and to the space that we have. Next production will change. I think my job is to give a place for really creative people to engage with their imagination. So the less prescriptive I am, the better. Like you see adverbs, like describing how a line should be read, angrily, surprised, and stuff like that. It's just prescriptive to the actor, and cut them all, take them out, let the actor make those choices, because it's not your job to insert yourself into their ability to engage and find their own answers. And so for me, I'm setting up a place for people to go and engage as much as they can. And the less I'm there in terms of dictation, the better.
Well, the play Birthday Candles by playwright Noah Heidel is making its world premiere at the Detroit Public Theater. And it runs now through June 3rd. You can get all the details by going to the website, DetroitPublicTheater.org. And I know you're a believer in them because you're on their board. And they've done a lot to add to Michigan's theater scene in their 3 seasons. Noah, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. It lingered there to touch your hair and walk with me.
Today is the 20th anniversary of Frank Sinatra's death, and yes, that's one of his greatest hits. But if you think that's old Blue Eyes you're hearing, think again. That's Sinatra as channeled by Bob Anderson. He's been a fixture in Vegas and on stages around the country with his show, Frank, the Man, the Music. It's coming to the Detroit Opera House Saturday, June 16th. Long before he became the embodiment of Sinatra, Bob Anderson grew up in Warren and graduated from Center Line High. Bob Anderson, welcome.
Cynthia, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
So tell me, what was some of the music you were listening to back in the old Center Line High days? Who'd you like growing up?
You know what? I liked everybody. I mean, living in Detroit, as you know, Motown, how do you not like Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson and Martha Reeves and the Temptations, everybody? Yeah. And I loved all that. I loved Elvis Presley. I loved Tom Jones. I loved Michael Jackson. But the main thing for me, I got hooked on the singers of the Great American Songbook. Mm. You know, Tony Bennett. Nat King Cole, Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Bobby Darin, all those guys.
What got you hooked on that? Was it the songs?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was the songs, but I really appreciated how well they were performed. I want my kids to always think that their music is the greatest music that ever happened at any time. I want them to feel that way about it in their generation. But you and I actually know the truth about all that.
Wink, wink.
The greatest music this world has ever known came from the, like, say, the 60s through the 80s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s.
Even 40s, some of those
in the 40s,
great
right.
songs, sure.
Well, what they did, though, because it was the best of everything they gave you. They had all the great composers, like the Gershwins and Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hart. And they would take the wonderful songs from the Broadway stages, and they would do those. And not only that, they had the greatest arrangers, Nelson Riddle, Don Costa, Gordon Jenkins, Billy May, all these people that arranged this stuff, Johnny Mandel, and then the singers. I became friends with all of the singers that I grew up listening to. It was really crazy. I caught the tail end of the golden age of the Strip.
How did you get from Warren, and I know you sang around Detroit for some time, get to Vegas and wind up being friends with all these legendary names?
Well, I'll tell you. I came back from Vietnam. I was in the 4th Infantry Division. I was only 20 years old when I got back, and I wanted to clear my head. You know, I had long hair, long curly hair, cut off sandals, a peace sign for a belt buckle. I even had a Volkswagen Beetle. So anyway, I got my Volkswagen and I drove out west. I was going to Los Angeles. I didn't know Route 66 took me to Las Vegas, out of Chicago. I wound up in Vegas. I slept in my car for 3 days, didn't have any money for a hotel and stuff. So I pulled my car in my old Volkswagen and parked way in the back of the hotel. Mm-hmm. And so I walked into the hotel and I see the Conga showroom. Well, I open up the door and a dude was there. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He says, "Yeah, can I help you, kid?" And I said, "No, man, I'm just looking around, buddy." So I walk away and he said, "Hey, kid, come here." He said, "Did you ever see a rehearsal?" I said, "No, I don't even know what it is." He said, "Well, they're practicing it here. Come on in. You want to see it?" He said, "It's Nancy Sinatra up here with the Everly Brothers. You can watch them." So I said, "Yeah, I'll sit down." I sat down, and in 2 minutes, they had a big argument. They got in a big fight, the Everly Brothers on the stage. They walked off. They had been rehearsing for 5 days, and they left the show. Nancy was caught, and she was going to open in 4 hours. And her whole act had to be changed. Everybody was in a panic. And I go and I tell the guy, "Hey," I said, "I'm a singer, man." And he laughed and he said, "You're a singer?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I can do whatever she needs." He said, "Well, go tell her." So I did. I walked up to the stage and I said, they were looking like, "How did he get in here?" And I said, "Excuse me." I said, Nancy. I said, "Hey, I'm a singer and I can do anything you need." And so I opened that evening in the Sahara Hotel with her, and I stayed with her touring. I took the Everly Brothers spot, and she brought me on the Merv Griffin show.
Yeah.
And I just sang a song. I was never doing any impressions.
You were just singing as you. Yeah.
As me, never an impressionist. But I grew up listening to all those singers. I would babysit for my brothers. I was the youngest one in the family, and I would put the speakers by my ears and just listen to Sinatra. I just fell in love with it. And Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett and Andy Williams, all these guys. And I would sing along to their records. And I tried to sing as closely as I could to what I was listening to. So I said, if I could sound like them, I'd be really doing great because they're the best. Now, I had no idea that subconsciously I was putting them embedded in my brain.
Sure were.
So years later, this happened. I did the Merv Griffin show. Paul Anka called me as soon as I was on the show with Nancy Sinatra. I get a phone call, and he says, "Bob, this is Paul Anka." I said, "Paul." He said, "I saw you on a Merv Griffin show, and I'm going to bring you back on next week with me." I said, "Can you do that?" He said, "I just told you this is Paul Anka."
I can do it.
So he did it. I did the show again. Merv Griffin came up to me after the show and said, Bob, we really like you on the show, but we just can't keep having you on here. You've either got to have a hit record, be in the movies, or do something. So I go to a party a year later to Merv Griffin's. I'm working with Joan Rivers at a workshop in Los Angeles. We go to the party. Everybody in Hollywood's there. It's his 50th birthday. I mean, Gregory Peck, Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart, everybody's there. Beach Boys. He plays the piano. I get up. Out of nowhere, I start singing the songs like the people who made him famous.
It just started. The impressions came out.
Yeah, and everybody, you could hear a pin drop in a second because nobody was doing singing impressions. Impressionists used to do actors or political figures.
Frank Gorshin, perfect example. The greatest.
Great friend of mine, Frank.
Yeah.
And so anyway, Merv said, we found your act. You're going to be the singing impressionist. And he was on the show, and he wrote a whole show for me. He took me back to Caesar's Palace on Friday, and he said, all those great stars are wrapped up in his necks, and you've got to hear him. He's known as the singing impressionist. So I became an impressionist.
So you now focus on Sinatra. Why did you gravitate and dive down into Sinatra?
He's the only one who transcends every generation. He's as popular today as he ever was. And not only here, that's all over the world what he is.
And he had a career that spanned decades.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with his music. It's all wonderful. So what we do now is the show gives an opportunity for the younger people to leave their high-tech world behind, see what show business used to be like, and come to a reenactment of Sinatra at Caesar's Palace in 1970.
And you have, and I know you're going to have, the 32-piece Johnny Trudell Orchestra with you when you are at the Detroit Opera House. Who has an orchestra that big anymore?
Nobody.
No,
nobody.
They don't.
And what's so funny about it, too, is that the arrangements were given to me from Frank Sinatra's musical director. They are all actually Frank Sinatra's in his hand chart.
What did Frank Sinatra say to Vincent Falcone about those arrangements?
Okay, here's what he did. When he was working with him, periodically after their show, Vince was with him for about 12 years, Sinatra would say, Vinny, here, take this chart home, make a copy of it and bring one back, keep one for yourself. So through the years, he wanted giving him 65 of his original arrangements of the greatest Sinatra collection. He told Vince when they went their separate ways, because Frank slowed down, he said, Vinny, there's a reason I gave you that music. I want you to keep it going for generations to hear as long as you can. And when you're done, you find somebody else that'll continue with it. So unfortunately, Vince, who was one of my best friends, passed away right after our show closed. He just got ill and he was gone. But he said to me, Bob, you have to carry this music on. So now I have the 65, and it's so crazy. Nobody in the world has this because people have takedown charts that try to sound like them, but they have Nelson Riddle on them and Sinatra's name is on them and I'm holding his music. So nothing in the show is caricature, nothing at all.
Did you ever meet Frank?
Yes, I worked with him 3 times.
So tell me.
And his daughter Nancy started me in the business.
Nancy started you. So what did he say to you?
I'm in the lounge just doing my regular act.
Regular act.
But I'm doing everybody.
The impressions,
I'm doing Bobby Darin and every one of those people, okay? And Frank saw me do it a number of times. So all of a sudden, it's Saturday night. I'm sitting at the bar in the lounge, and I'm looking at a big mirror, and here comes a little ant pile through the casino. And into the room comes Frank Sinatra, and he walks up to me, and he grabs me by his shoulders, and he said, you know, I wouldn't have missed this kid. So he goes and sits down in a front seat, front table, that he was 3 feet from me because it was so intimate that the back of the piano was hitting my butt and I was sitting right there and singing. He comes in, then Diana Ross walks in after him, then Dean Martin, then Johnny Mathis and Sarah Vaughan and Steve Wynn and Elaine, they all come in.
You have nerves of steel.
Oh, my goodness. So they were wondering what I was going to do, and I said, let me try to recreate a few singers for you. And, of course, I said, how about Tony Bennett? Is that all right? Can I do Tony? And I went into, you know, for once in my life, I have someone that needs me, you know, and all this stuff. And I sang it. And then I turned around and I did Sammy Davis Jr. You know, what kind of fool am I? And I was doing all this stuff here, Sammy. And then Dean Martin starts talking to me as Sammy. So Dean's got his foot on the stage because it was that close. And I kicked his foot off of there. And I said, "That you ain't in this show, buddy. Get your foot off the stage." So Sinatra laughs. And they're waiting to see, is this guy going to do Frank Sinatra?
In front of Sinatra, right in front of his nose.
And I did. I did the song that Sammy Kahn wrote, When Somebody Loves You All the Way. And I did it. He loved it. I came down and sat with him. We went out to dinner after the show. He said to me, he's a kid, he says, you got a hell of an act. And he said, you stick with this one. You got a hell of an act. So that's I kept that one, boy.
Boy, that is something to take. Well, you can get a preview of all of that by being at the Detroit Opera House on Saturday, June 16th for Frank, the Man, the Music, starring Warren and Centerline High School's own Bob right. Anderson. Bob, will you take us out with a song?
I certainly will. Love to, yeah. As one of Sinatra's big hits. You make me feel so young. You make me think that spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to run and play hide and seek. I want to go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. 'Cause you and I are just like a couple of tots running around the meadow and picking up all those forget-me-nots. You make me feel so young.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If certain health plans and legislators get their way, Michigan's mental health system could soon be privatized. Pretty much everyone agrees that closer coordination of mental and physical health care would be a good thing for patients. After all, the mind is connected to the body. But just how to get there has been up for fierce debate going on 2 years now. In passing its version of the Department of Health and Human Services budget for 2018-19, the Senate added a provision that has advocates and mental health providers concerned. Here with us now is Kevin Fisher, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He's been following these developments very closely. Kevin, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me back.
How worried are you about this latest development?
Very concerned, because it signals to me that the legislature who decided to privatize the mental health system continues to signal that we can't take their word.
When you stop and think that the state Senate, led by Senator Mike Shirkey, Clark Lake Republican, approved this provision that would allow private health plans to contract with agencies other than community mental health authorities, explain to us why, in your view, this is a problem.
Well, the problem becomes that, one, it undermines the community mental health system. Even after the Senate decided to privatize the community mental health system and move forward with the pilots, a part of the original agreement was that all specialty services still had to be contracted through the community mental health local departments, and that the health plans had to contract with the community mental health departments for those services. Now it appears they're rolling that back and circumventing the community mental health system, which would decimate the system financially and for services to the people who we serve.
The health plans, they say they can do it better on their own and argue, hey, we've done well on the physical health side. Why not give us a chance? So what gives you pause?
Because saying we can do it better is not good enough. The evidence suggests that they can't. Now, I will add here that I recently spoke with an official from one of the health plans who said that this was not an attempt to circumvent the CMH system, and that they too expected this language proposed in 298E to be revised or removed.
You talked about evidence. What evidence, Kevin, suggests to you that they cannot perform, they can't do it better on their own?
Well, one, because they don't specialize in severe and pervasive. To this point, the health plans have pretty much only had experience with what's referred to as mild to moderate mental health disorders. And the information that we've seen shows that that hasn't been managed as well as it could. So to take the leap from mild to moderate to more serious mental illness just doesn't make sense, because there's no evidence that suggests that they have the network or the knowledge to do so.
There was an agreement that was, hashed out after months and months of meetings to put forth three pilot projects that would explore how the community mental health agencies, the health plans, and service providers could better integrate physical and mental health care. Now, the original deadline to get those up and running was October 1st of this year. The state just announced last week it's pushing that back an entire year, so October 2019. Why the delay?
Well, the delay is because, one, this was a hastily put together process. I can't say thought out, because I don't think it was well thought out. The Senate moved this process to the health plans without any plan of how to execute it. They left the department in a situation where they didn't have time to come up with a plan to execute it. And so we're not surprised that the pilot deadline or start date has been pushed back. We are surprised that it's a whole year. None of the officials that I've spoken to on either side believe that they need an entire additional year.
Hmm. If that language, Kevin Fisher, makes it into the final budget, will health plans still take part in these pilot projects? Do you think they'll still have a reason to participate?
I think they would have a reason to participate, but I don't think it's in either their best interest or in the best interest of the people we serve. Again, the officials that I've spoken to agree that the community mental health departments are best equipped, have the history and knowledge to deal with these issues. While the health plans do have some expertise they can bring to the table with regard to efficiencies, it's simply not in this area. And I think they know that and are willing to frankly admit that they're not specialists in this area. So I think Senator Shirky's language was hasty and irresponsible and needs to be removed effective immediately.
What does this tell you? What do you think is behind this language, that you brand as hasty?
I think what's behind it is, one, he's clearly not listening to the people or the advocates. And I think it further demonstrates that he does not have a good understanding of our public mental health system and what it takes to yield the best outcomes for the people we serve. At the end of the day, we all understand their budgetary concerns. We all understand their politics at play here. But what's being forgotten are the people that we serve and building better lives for them, which frankly benefits us all.
And when you think of these people you serve and their families, what concerns you the most? Should the state go this route and let the health plans contract with whomever they'd like?
Short answer is no. And it's because the people we serve have been trying to speak for the last 2 years and their voices have been ignored. So that's the first concern that I have. The second is, again, to me, it demonstrates a complete lack of knowledge or understanding of what it takes to deliver the services that build better lives for the people we serve. This will take us down a more costly road. The people we serve will have less choice. The providers may not be vetted properly. There are a host of concerns that we have here that simply haven't been addressed. If we're going to combine the public community mental health system with the health plans, at least let's bring the best of the two worlds together instead of hastily circumventing and shortcutting the system just to push a program through that just hasn't been well thought out.
Kevin Fisher, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Kevin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Senator Shirky sent us a statement in response that reads in part, and I quote here, "By allowing Medicaid health plans to contract with additional service providers, it is my hope that these pilots will show a pathway to increased access to timely, high-quality care. It is disappointing that some CMHs continue to fight testing the opportunities integration affords. CMHs should focus on ensuring their services are compelling and productive, so health plans in these pilots would conclude they are the best provider. But more often than not, what we're witnessing is a strong resistance to changing status quo. It is very important to remind everyone the only objective of these pilots is to honestly and robustly test full integration in order to free up more resources for mental and behavioral health. How do you know if nursing homes and assisted living communities are treating you or a loved one properly, and what do you do if they're not? To answer these questions, we turn to Allison Herschel, the managing attorney for the Michigan Elder Justice Initiative, and Carrie Jordan, the long-term care ombudsman for Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, we asked Michigan Radio listeners to serve up questions that they have that they would love for you to be able to answer about elder care in Michigan. So we're going to start out with a voicemail we got from an anonymous listener in Kalamazoo.
Hi, this is regarding the adults in the assisted living facilities, the ASCs. Why is it these companies can hire girls off the street with no accreditation, no certification, no experience, and put them on a med cart, label them a med tech after a short class in service, and say, here you go, here's some narcotics, please pass them. You don't know what these meds are and what these meds can do if you mess it up, but here you go.
Allison, do you want to take that?
There is a shortage of direct care workers across the state and across the country, and that's partly because these are really backbreaking and challenging jobs, and they pay very poorly. We know that it's much more challenging to get good quality care if you're not paying people appropriately for the importance of the work that they do. The other issue I'd say about the staffing at adult foster care facilities, adult foster care facilities are licensed and there are regulations that govern who can work there and what the requirements for working there are. But those facilities don't have nearly the regulatory oversight that nursing homes do. So you will find people with less training and less oversight than you would find in a nursing home. Carrie, would you say more about that?
I can't speak to all of the regulations for licensed adult foster cares, but I do know that the caregivers are given a ton of on-the-job training. They are not required to have any certification. The adult foster cares are required to have some sort of nurse on staff, but the nurse doesn't have to be present 24 hours a day. And so the caregivers who are passing meds are trained by those nurses. And the training has to be sufficient enough for licensing to agree to it.
So the direct care workers who work in nursing homes are required to be certified, but that's not true in the other facilities in the state. I would say to the caller, if she thinks that there is a problem with the quality of care someone's receiving because someone who doesn't have sufficient training is passing meds and making errors, or if there are other specific concerns, we'd be glad to look into those, and we encourage people to call the Ombudsman Program. We go out to facilities every day, and we'll follow up on specific concerns like that. We still, unfortunately, sometimes have to work within the regulatory structure, but if a resident is at risk of harm or being harmed, then we want to jump in and see how we can help to stop that from happening.
And while we're on that point, is there one central number people should call? How can people reach?
Yes, there is a statewide number. It's 866-485-9393, and it will route the caller to the local long-term care ombudsman like Carrie in the area that they're calling from.
I guess I'm curious what kind of common types of complaints you've gotten over the past several years.
I think a lot of, this is Allison, and I think a lot of the issues we hear about result from the fact that most nursing homes are short-staffed. So people have to wait an awfully long time when they ring their call bell, and mistakes happen and people aren't attended to as quickly as they need to be assisted. We also have seen a real increase in the number of involuntary discharges when facilities decide they don't want to take care of someone anymore. But one really important thing is that there is a very robust body of law, both federal law and state law, that protects people in those situations and that also guarantees their rights in many, many aspects of life in a nursing home. So, you know, we think that if Congress and the state legislature took the trouble to pass laws protecting people, those laws need to be enforced. We want to find out what the resident wants, but we also want the residents to know that they have real rights and we're there to help support them and enforce those.
And somewhat along similar lines, we heard from Patrick Smetowski from Canton, who wrote in,
and asked this question, I can learn regularly about restaurant health code violations via, for example, MLive. So why not something similarly public for elder care providers? So I guess the question is there anyone in Michigan monitoring health care violations at elder care facilities?
Yes, and if you know where to look, there's actually voluminous information about nursing homes and some information about homes for the aged and adult foster care facilities. One of the best sources of information is Medicare.gov. If you go to their homepage on the left-hand side, you can click on Find a Nursing Home, and that webpage has tremendous information on every certified facility in the country. So you can plug in the area that you're looking at or the name of the facility, and you can find out what kind of violations, detailed violations they've had in the last three inspections that have taken place at the facility. You can see what their staffing is like, what their quality measures are like, whether they're rated a one-star facility or a five-star facility. And if you're in a facility, the facility, a nursing home, is required to have their most recent survey present in the facility, and you can look at it there and also see what their plan of correction is for any violation that they were cited for. For homes for the aged and adult foster care, you can look on the LARA website. That's the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. You can look up a facility, and there's much less information, but at least you can get a sense if this facility has been in trouble or if it seems to have a clean record.
You know, in talking about regulations, if a good care plan is put together, it's all in writing. And so surveyors can come and look to make sure that the care plan is actually being done appropriately.
We're also curious about what gets missed.
First of all, and I should say, it's the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs that's responsible for conducting surveys, investigations, and oversight of nursing homes and adult foster care and homes for the aged. What gets missed a lot of times are things that don't happen in front of the surveyors. In nursing homes, they're only in the facility approximately once a year. If somebody complains about something that's happened and the surveyor comes back and can't substantiate that complaint because it's not happening in front of them, those are the things that often get missed. Other things that get missed are things that happen and that are very troubling and sometimes dangerous for residents, but residents and their families don't want to complain because they don't want to rock the boat. The residents are often very vulnerable. They're in that nursing home 24 hours a day, and so sometimes they're afraid of retaliation, and a lot of the things that happen to people don't get reported.
Such as? What kinds of things?
A lot of times, it has to do with their care. They're afraid to complain that a caregiver has said something or hasn't helped them or hasn't provided the care that they've needed. But I think there's a culture in nursing homes that residents enter them sometimes and think, oh, well, this is just how it is. I just have to wait 15 minutes to use the bathroom, or I have to wait an hour to use the bathroom, or I can only take a shower once a week. And that's really not the case. It's important that the residents know that they do have a say in how their care is provided and what kind of care they're receiving. And it's all supposed to be person-centered. And retaliation is against regulation. And that's where the ombudsman come in as well, to help a resident have a voice to talk about what they want.
But I can sure see where a dilemma sets in if you have a loved one, let's say, a mother in a nursing home who perhaps has dementia and isn't able to voice things, and you're not there 24/7 as the daughter to know what's going on.
Yeah, and that's a very serious issue. We always encourage families and other loved ones to the greatest extent possible to be at the facility often and at unpredictable times, because the best way to make sure that someone you care about is getting good care is to be there yourself. But that's, of course, not always possible.
Allison, do you think elder care in Michigan is improving? And if not, what needs to be done to get to the point where things do improve?
Well, I think the biggest issue right now is that we don't have enough home and community-based services. People are desperate to get those services in their own homes instead of in nursing homes. And our state has lagged behind other states in providing those opportunities. So if you need a nursing home bed, you'll almost certainly be able to find a nursing home bed. But if you want to receive help in your home, in many parts of the state, you have to go on a long waiting list before you qualify for services. I don't think that we're seeing a significant improvement in quality of care in nursing homes or other facilities. But that said, there are some really innovative models that provide a much more home-like environment or much more person-centered. So with luck, people can find options that really suit their needs, but we need to expand those options that really satisfy what people are looking for in a facility or in home care.
Allison Herschel is the managing attorney for the Michigan Elder Justice Initiative, and Carrie Jordan is the long-term care ombudsman for Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.